Knock, knock.
Hi. Can you take a break? Hi, I'm Officer Gladys, but you can call me Bill. I know you got a couple questions about why you're here, and I want to help you in any way I can. You see, we're wondering what happened the night of October 14th, and I didn't want to get any of those pesky lawyers in here. I just figured I would talk to you friend to friend, you know, because this is a safe space.
Knock, fucking knock.
All right, Bixby, calm down.
You calm down, Gladys. You calm down! Hello, America's favorite scumbag! You piece of shit. Get your fucking hands off me.
Bixby, he's an innocent man.
Shut the fuck up, Gladys! Why don't you tell us where you were the night of October 14th? Just tell us. You're not gonna talk, huh? Okay.
Bixby, no! Come on! We'll not have you terrorize our fucking head off!
Why don't you take a break, Gladys?
Okay, I will. Hit up the vending machine. You guys want anything? My choice? All right. See you in a second.
Sure. Oh, did I spit in your coffee? Sorry about that. Real fucking sorry about that. And that! Give me a reason not to blow your head off, huh? Give me one fucking reason. I'll blow my head off all over your head.
I got granola bars. Woohoo! Granola bar for you and a granola. What the hell happened in here?
I spilled my coffee.
All right, well, why don't you get a broom or something and clean this up?
Sure. But I'm coming back for you. Bronk.
Ugh, Bixby. He's a clumsy guy. And between you and me, he's got a bit of a hot head. But, you know that. You kind of get me, don't you? You and I see eye to eye. I don't know if it's the light or something, but you look beautiful. Maybe you and I can keep some things secret in here. Like this kiss.
What's going on?
What?
I just can't catch a break today. I went to take a shit, but someone was in my favorite stall. But I remembered to swing by my office where I found all this evidence from the mayor's re-election speech. Maybe you remember?
The mayor's re-election. I'm going to play you a little snippet to kind of refresh your memory. Why don't you just close your eyes and picture yourself there? It was the mayor's re-election campaign.
We have picked ourselves up. We have fought our way back.
And then it happened.
So yes, it was yet to...
Oh, God. What is that smell?
Chaos in the streets. And people died. There you have it. There you have it.
Who could have done this?
You remember?
Was it you?
Was it?
Was it you?
Was it you? Were you the person who farted on October 14th? Yes or no?
You know what, Gladys? This monster, they're not going to talk. So I'm going to give them a taste of their own medicine. This is an air sample from the scene of the crime.
Bixby. No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Oh, God.
No.
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 Lid is tight.
No. No.
Oh, I can't get it.
No.
I got it.
No. Oh.
Shit on a piece of doo-doo.
Oh, that's exactly what it sounds like. I started taking shit off the doo.
Oh, God.
God. All right, you two, that's enough.
Dude.
Jesus Christ. Smells like a goddamn fart in here.
It was him.
Did you get a confession, yes or no?
I mean, we tried. I mean, I knocked over the chair.
I did the good cop
thing. Smashed the mugs.
Seduction.
I pulled my gun out.
I brought the stuff from the vending machine.
Shut up! Now you listen to me, and you listen good. Because we know you were there. Now tell me, did you or did you not fart on the night of October 14th? Let him go, guys.
What?
No way! Why?
What do you mean?
Because whoever smelt it, dealt it. They didn't smelt it. They didn't dealt it.
What?
I suggest you get yourself checked by a medical professional.
Well, I am so sorry about this. If you have any complaints, you can just never hesitate to call me. If you want to just hang out. No? Okay. Have a good day. Torres, uncuff him.
You like that for a kickoff of the show on summer solstice today? How about that? So, my funnies are funny to some people. They're not funny to everybody. I'm sure the conservative right-wing radio talk shows would not run that on their show. But you don't know what you're going to hear on my show. Terrible Tommy here, and it's June the, what is it over there? I can't see my clock. Got to turn on my other light here. I'm sitting in the dark. June 20th, 2016. And it's a warm day, pretty warm, and we got a warm wind, and so forth and so on. So, but not much humidity. That's good. That's good. For the winter solstice, summer solstice. Well, I see the Congress and the Senate are all wrangling over what to do about the guns. We got gun problems everywhere, guns. Yeah, they're trying to pass some laws today. Bet you they don't get them passed. I'll bet you they don't get them passed. The military arms industrial complex doesn't need to be limited in their scope. And the NRA does big business with the military-industrial complex. I don't know just how much, but they have a lot of influence in Washington. Yeah, that's for sure. If they announced tomorrow that they were sending trucks out from house to house to pick up weapons, wouldn't bother me a bit. Because if you haven't made arrangements for that kind of a problem, then it's almost too late. No, they're not going to come around and pick up your weapons. That's the Republican conservatives use that to beat you over the head with. They're coming. They're going to take all your guns. Yeah, right. I think we got quite a ways to go before it gets to that point. We're not to the bottom yet. We're at the beginning of the precipice to head to the bottom, but we're not anywhere near the bottom.
Thank you. I've been listening to the discussion, and I'm a military wife. My husband's on his third tour to Iraq. And I just want to, if I could look Mr. Crystal and people like him from the American Enterprise Institute, these people that are still pushing the war, I sleep 2 hours a night. I'm sure when your head hits your pillow, you know, you have the luxury of dreaming about, you know, anything that your mom will allow you to dream about. I'm waiting. I sleep with a phone under my pillow. My kids, if someone rings the doorbell, instead of doing what normal kids do, they freeze. And they're in elementary school. You all don't understand. We're military people, but we're people too. And the stress that we are under is tremendous. So I'll make a proposal before I have to leave the air. If this war is as important as you on the right and the hawks say it is, and if it is truly essential to our vital interest to do this, then institute the draft so we can have a break. We are at the breaking point. I just had to counsel a friend last night who has had a solid marriage for 14 years because their marriage is falling apart because they're dual military and they haven't lived under the same roof together in 5 years. We're people. We can't keep up this stress level. Our children can't keep up this stress level. The spouses left behind can't keep up this stress level. And all you all keep saying, you just called my husband and all his truth a liar when you said it's mostly the insurgents attacking us. Because when I do get the luxury of speaking to my husband, what I'm hearing is the Iraqis let us through the gate, the security forces will let us through the gate, and 30 minutes after we pass through, they're laying down IEDs to blow us up when we come back through. They don't want us there. I understand you truly believe what you're saying, but it's not working. We can't want it for them more than they want it for themselves. Please bring my husband home. Please bring our brave troops home. We're tired. We're really tired.
Thank you.
Some of us have been arguing. Well, first of all, I really respect, obviously, the service of those who have been over there. We had dinner last night with close friends whose son just got back from Iraq, and it is tough duty, obviously, and now we're on second and third tours. Some of us argued for a long time before 9/11 and very vehemently after 9/11 that the Army and Marines were too small for the world we are living in, for the foreign policy obligations we are likely to have to impose on our military, for the warfighting obligations we're going to have to impose on the all-volunteer military. And finally, we're increasing the size of the Army and the Marines, but we're paying a price for that in terms of longer tours and people going back a second and third times, and the strains on family life are obviously very real, and obviously it's a tough job over there. So I hope we do more to deal with that.
You go so far as her thought on the draft?
Well, there you go. That's the problem we have with the neocons. That guy is a rat. He's always been a rat. He's a Jew. But you don't have to be Jewish to be a bastard. Think of all the poor wives and families of these guys. They volunteer. I question why a man would volunteer if he's got a wife and kids at home. But they do. And the thing is, I've said we should go back to the draft. But the draft was crooked, too. I knew plenty of working class guys that were on the wrong side of the track. And I don't mean blacks, even though there were a lot of blacks drafted. They were taken away, and they were put in jail if they didn't go. If they had brains, they went to Canada and got out of here. So that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a ruling class that is totally criminal, corrupt, and deserve to be judged, tried, and executed. That's my belief. I'm trying to think of anybody up there, any place in Washington or the state houses that I could say, now there's a real guy, there's a real gal. Now I'll follow that person. Yeah. Well, we're into the chaos factor number two. And as of today, the Donald Trump train is starting to get some loose wheels on it, which I predicted a long time ago. It's going to end up, they're going to sidetrack him. But don't worry about it. He's not genuine anyhow. I keep telling people. We like a lot of things he said, but they don't mean anything because he said other things before. So now his campaign manager has quit him. And there's going to be a lot of other people leave his employ. And they're figuring ways now of waylaying him before or at the convention. Chaos Factor 2 is working quite well. Now, there are millions of working class white guys out there and women that have bought into Donald Trump. And it would be nice to be able to do that. But guys like him never could be trusted. They never, ever could be trusted. Remember Perot? He had $9 billion, he said. And he could feel our pain. You got to understand, boys and girls, these people are all filthy, rotten, syndicate crooks. And they're not going to change. They're going to get worse. They're going to get worse. But to think you're going to vote for one of them and get someplace, forget it. Every time you vote for one of them, it gets worse. So the problem with this volunteer army thing is a lot of these guys are gung-ho. They want to go kill something. They do. I know. I've met them. So they go over there, and it wouldn't be so bad if they just got themselves killed, but they kill a whole bunch of people in the country they're in, and then those people in that country hate us, and then they get over here, which is very easy to get over here, and then they want to kill you and me. And we had nothing to do with it. We had nothing to do with it, man. It's all a part of the good old military-industrial complex and the media that supports them, the media that covers for them, the media that lies for them. That's what you got to face. And the only thing that can help is chaos. Worse is better for now. Worse is better for now. I was listening to the radio today, and they're talking about all this gun thing. We got to stop assault weapons. Most of these left-wing progressives don't know anything about guns. They talk about guns like they're experts. They don't know shit about guns. But the point is, any gun can kill you. And what they're saying is that there are too many bullets in the clip. Well, you don't have to outlaw the gun. You could just have smaller clips. But the guys in the back of their garages are going to make big clips no matter what you do. You're not going to stop this thing. But I'll tell you what will happen if you really come down on the assault, so-called assault weapons. I say any gun can be an assault weapon. If you really come down hard on it, guess what's coming next? Going back to basics, bombs. You wait and see. They keep enough rifles and high magazine guns out of the hands of people, the so-called terrorists, and they'll go back to basics, bombs. And that's even worse, that indiscriminately killing like that. It's very odd for a guy to pick up a gun and shoot 50 people, even though he could. But it's not odd for somebody to build a bomb and toss it in a place and it kills everybody, you know. So you're not going to get away from it. This empire is eating its tail and it's causing everybody to go crazy. Are my friends crazy? No. Are my friends stockpiling hundreds of guns? No. I never advocated that. No. If I stockpiled lots of guns, well, I have, I think, 6 guns, and they're all small bore, no assault, so-called assault rifle, and 22s, shotguns, a 45, and let's see, 357. But the 357 and one shotgun were given to me as gifts. They've never been fired, so essentially I've got about 3 guns. And I don't get excited about guns. If I need a gun bad enough, I know how to get a gun. I take it off somebody who's got one. Very simple. It's not that hard to get a gun. You don't have to have a gun until the last minute. If you want a gun, go out and see somebody with a gun, take it away from them. Then you don't have to worry about them giving you trouble by having it in your closet. You saw the movie Leningrad. I don't know whether that was the title of the movie, but where the Germans had a top sniper and the Russians had a top sniper. Now that's the kind of warfare I believe in. They had hundreds and thousands and millions of guys running around shooting at each other, but these guys were after each other one-on-one. with that telescopic sight. And they knocked them off all over the place. It's clean. You're not killing a whole bunch of other people. You're just getting the one you want. So I really liked that movie. I really did. Everybody was going crazy shooting at each other. You know, thousands of men being lost. And the movie was about just two guys going after each other. Now, wouldn't that make it a lot nicer if that's what happened in society? Somebody wanted somebody. Don't hurt other people. Just go after the one you want. If it is something that's really needed. Instead of going off half-cocked like a lot of guys do and shoot somebody over nothing like the unwashed and untouchables do. They shoot on the spur of the moment, just start shooting. One thing good about them, they're lousy shots. They're lousy shots. You notice all these guys over in the Middle East and these militias, they show them out on the firing line. They're not hitting anything. The way they shoot the guns, they point, get the guns over their head and just shoot them until the ammo's gone. Or they take a bazooka and fire. They're not hitting anything. They're destroying a lot of property, but they're not hitting anything. It's funny as hell. Just think of the millions of dollars these people are going through just shooting into the air. And mostly they do it when the press is around. You know, they got to make a show when the press is around. I've got something I'm going to play for you today that I think is going to solve some of our problems, especially with the Muslims. Because Mother Nature's getting pissed off. She really is. And I think she's going to change the foundation of this struggle. So here we go. We're going to have Cynthia today tell you about it.
By Jonathan Marshall. While Washington decision makers debate whether to launch the United States military strikes against the government of President Bashar al-Assad, as if Syria suffers from a shortage of war and foreign intervention, the United States continues to ignore underlying issues that have helped trigger recent conflicts in the Middle East and threaten to create much bigger upheavals in decades to come. Taking the long view, our number one enemy should not be Assad, or even ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, but climate change. Predictions by climate scientists that the Middle East will become nearly uninhabitable by the end of the century barring decisive global action to curb carbon pollution put all current conflicts into much-needed perspective. Experts have been warning for years about the social and political implications of environmental stresses. Consider these cautionary words from the International Institute for Sustainable Development in 2009. Already the Middle East as a whole is the world's most dependent region on wheat imports. If climate change begins to reduce agricultural yields at the same time as international food prices rise, food insecurity, both perceived and real, will increase. This, in turn, could alter the economic and strategic balance in every country in the region. As Canadian security analyst and journalist Gwyn Dyer notes, eating regularly is a non-negotiable activity, and countries that cannot feed their people are unlikely to be reasonable about it. One year later, a perfect storm made that warning come true. Record rainfall cut the wheat harvest in Canada, the world's second largest wheat exporter, by almost a quarter. Severe drought and wildfires wiped out nearly 40% of Russia's potential wheat harvest. Extreme weather in late 2010 also devastated crops in the United States and Argentina. A once-in-a-century drought led China, usually the world's largest wheat producer, to begin buying up grain on the international market. Spreading chaos. As a result, global wheat prices doubled from the summer of 2010 to February 2011, reaching an all-time high. The spike hit the Middle East, home to the world's nine top per capita wheat importers, like a plague of locusts. Protesters in Tunisia, the birthplace of the Arab Spring, waved baguettes to signal their anger over food prices. Similar demonstrations struck Yemen and Jordan. In Egypt, where 40% of personal income is spent on food, and bread accounts for a third of the typical consumer's calories, the food crisis fed popular discontent that spilled over into mass anti-government demonstrations on Tahrir Square that spring. In Africa's impoverished Sahel, drought and desertification drove hundreds of thousands of desperate migrants to Libya in recent years. The clash between indigenous Arabs and sub-Saharan black Africans helped trigger the uprising against Muammar Gaddafi. His opponents fueled the revolt by accusing black immigrants of taking jobs and becoming mercenaries to keep Gaddafi in power. As a result, Western-backed rebels brutally abused and slaughtered thousands of darker-skinned migrants. In Syria, the worst four-year drought in its history drove hundreds of thousands of hungry families off their farms from 2006 to 2010. The mass migration overwhelmed the Assad government, which was already stressed by foreign economic sanctions and a huge influx of refugees from the U.S.-led war in Iraq. The tinder was laid for a revolt sparked by internal dissent, fanned by the regime's overreactions, and stoked by foreign intervention. 4 years ago, the United Nations predicted that Egypt could become water scarce by 2025, in part due to population growth and upstream diversions of water from the Nile. Climate change has accelerated the timetable. According to recent reports, drinking water shortages have left parts of Egypt going thirsty for up to 2 weeks in the run-up to Ramadan, with popular frustration over the failure of authorities to tackle the crisis spilling onto the streets. The water shortages have exacerbated an already difficult Ramadan in Egypt, which saw food prices increase by 12.7% in April compared to the same month last year. The cost of rice, an Egyptian staple, has more than doubled compared to last year's Ramadan. Pummeling Iraq. Climate change is battering war-torn Iraq as well. As three experts warned in Foreign Affairs magazine last year, the Tigris-Euphrates River basin, which feeds Syria and Iraq, is rapidly drying up. This vast area already struggles to support at least 10 million conflict-displaced people. And things could soon get worse. Iraq is reaching a crisis point. In Karbala, Iraq, farmers are in despair and are reportedly considering abandoning their land. In Baghdad, the poorest neighborhoods rely on the Red Cross for drinking water. President George W. Bush, in a flight suit after landing on the USS Abraham Lincoln to give his mission accomplished speech about the Iraq War. President George W. Bush in a flight suit after landing on the USS Abraham Lincoln to give his mission accomplished speech about the Iraq War. Further south, Iraq's famous marshes are drying up. What a recent report on NBC News called a catastrophe in the making for one of the world's most important wetlands, is evolving into a human emergency. Besides wiping out the livelihood of herders and fishermen, it has contributed to a sharp rise in the frequency and intensity of sand and dust storms, extending deep into Iran and Kuwait. Many inhabitants report severe respiratory problems as a result. Competition over fresh water supplies is aggravating conflicts within the region. Turkey, which lies upstream from Syria and Iraq, has radically reduced water flows to those neighbors since 1975 to serve its urban and farm needs and is building new dams to take even more, in the face of international protests and even threats of military action from its neighbors. Meanwhile, in Iraq, the Kurdish regional government has threatened to withhold irrigation water as part of its power struggle with Baghdad. And ISIS, which controls major dams in the country, last year put farmers in four predominantly Shiite Iraqi provinces at risk by cutting flows down the Euphrates River. The social, economic, and political challenges to the region of coping with heat, drought and related ills are certain to grow. As one climate scientist at Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory said recently, the Mediterranean is one of the areas that is unanimously projected in climate models as going to dry in the future due to man-made climate change. The World Bank estimated last month that future water shortages could slash the region's GDP by 14% by the middle of this century unless countries in the Middle East undertake major investments and radically improve their water management practices to cope with drought. Such dry statistics likely portend further political upheavals, civil wars, and refugee migrations. As President Obama said in 2014, if you look at world history, whenever people are desperate, when people start lacking food, when people are not able to make a living or take care of their families, that's when ideologies arise that are dangerous. Scientific studies prove him right. More war is not an answer. If we take his common sense insight seriously, then sending more anti-tank rockets to insurgent rebels and bombing a continuously shifting array of opponents from Iraq to Yemen is unlikely to provide lasting solutions for the region. Washington should instead be providing technical assistance, aid to strengthen critical infrastructure, and encouragement for regional collaboration. Saudi King Salman bids farewell to President Barack Obama at Erga Palace after a state visit to Saudi Arabia on January 27, 2015. Official White House photo by Pete Souza. As two researchers at the Center for American Progress declared in 2013, given the shape of these challenges, a new approach is necessary. The United States, its allies, and the global community must de-emphasize traditional notions of hard security more suited to the Cold War, and should focus on more appropriate concepts such as human security, livelihood protection, and sustainable development. That lesson, of course, will apply increasingly around the world as droughts imperil food and power production, as rising sea levels swamp island nations and coastal cities, and as increasing heat spreads disease vectors. If the United States want to act like an indispensable nation, it's time for Washington to demonstrate greater leadership on combating climate change and helping other nations cope with the enormous stress it brings. Jonathan Marshall is author or co-author of 5 books on international affairs, including The Lebanese Connection, Corruption, Civil War, and the International Drug Traffic. Stanford University Press, 2012. Some of his previous articles for Consortium News were a risky blowback from Russian sanctions, the United States' hand in the Syrian mess, hidden origins of Syria's civil war, and Israel covets Golan's water and now oil.
Sounds a little bit like chaos, huh, boys and girls? Is that enough chaos for you? You think it's not going to happen in this country? Are you kidding? The temperatures are on the rise big time. The wells are getting deeper and deeper out west. They have been for 25 years. And so it's not nice to fool Mother Nature. We've depleted the soil. We're pumping it full of toxic fertilizer. It's going to quit giving up crops one of these days. They're so interested in raising more and more valueless grains and so forth to ship across the ocean and make lots of money. Oh, it's going to be a great century, boys and girls. It's going to be great. And just think, I gave it to you. Chaos. Chaos 1, we're into Chaos 2. And Chaos 2 may last quite a bit longer. It will last a lot longer than Chaos 1. And then there's Chaos 3 down the line. So stay tuned for a chaos report. Going to be interesting to watch all the ruling class and the military-industrial complex and all their buddies in the media try to keep a lid on this, try to keep it under control, try to hopefully turn it around. It's not going to happen, boys and girls. It's not going to happen. And one other thing. Why are the corporations, the big corporations, not as interested in oil as they used to be? Because they're grabbing up all the water sources around the world. You don't own your own water in your own town or your own county. The only way you have any ownership of water is if you have a well of your own. But I know that the water in the town... I know the water in my own town here is not owned by the people. And you check with your various communities all over the country, and you'll find out you don't own the water. The taxpayers don't own the water. It's owned by giant conglomerates. And they've gone through South America and all over the place grabbing the water sources. So I guess that means that there's going to be a lot of shooting going on, because there are going to be a lot of revolts going on, a lot of civil wars, and a lot of, because people want their water. They want to drink. They want to eat. So there we go. Chaos. Well, here's a little interesting piece of Jewish caca. It's called, today's supposed to be, no, the 20th. Is this 20th? Is this the 20th? Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, turn on that light up there, man. Come on, Jerry the Jew, you're in charge of lights. 20th, yeah. Well, guess what it is today? World Refugee Day. And they're having a special naturalization ceremony today at 2 p.m. That's over with. In a live-streamed event with U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, many refugees and asylees will take the oath of allegiance at the museum. Allegiance to what? Many of today's global refugee policies were developed in the wake of the Holocaust. There it is. Yeah, sir. They didn't want any blocks at the border, because they wanted to be able to drag their criminal networks and activities all over the world without being interfered with, so they didn't care who else came in. At a time when we are facing the largest refugee crisis since World War II, invader crisis, these candidates remind us of the moral and legal responsibility we have to individuals fleeing persecution and violence. Well, pretty soon you and I are going to be fleeing persecution and violence, because there won't be any room left in this country. Yeah, well, where are we going to go?
Welcome to the museum. I'm Sarah Bloomfield, privileged to be its director, and we have many very special guests with us today, officials of the United States government, members of the diplomatic corps, several refugee agencies, UNHCR, Church World Service, Refugees International, HIAS, the Hebrew Immigration Aid Society, the International Rescue Committee, the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, the Catholic Bishops Conference, and many other organizations who have helped refugees and immigrants settle in this country. We also have with us guests who are always very privileged and honored in this institution, survivors of the Holocaust. We welcome you, and our very, very special guests today, candidates for U.S. citizenship. We want to welcome you to this institution, which was created to teach the history and the lessons of the Holocaust. These are lessons about the fragility of freedom, the nature of hate, and the consequences of indifference. All of my own great-grandparents immigrated to this country. It's the single most important thing I can tell you about myself. I'm in debt to them every single day of my life. They came here for the promise of America, for a country founded not on a people, but on an idea, the idea of freedom and justice for all. On one side of my family, they left Germany and England around the time of the American Civil War, seeking economic betterment. On the other side, they fled anti-Semitic violence in Tsarist Russia at the end of the 19th century. Yet even without the fear of violence, life in Russia was grim. Jewish boys as young as 12 could be inscripted into the Tsar's army for 25 years. So they came, as did millions before and after them, seeking the American idea of opportunity and liberty, and they found it. Luckily, they came when they did, because by the time their grandchildren were born, the doors to this country were closing. new ideas and new fears started taking hold in the U.S. and the world over. It started with ideas about race. Some call it racial science. Today, we would call it racist science. When immigration to America peaked in 1907 to over 1 million people, concerns about America's so-called racial stock became a public policy issue. In 1911, the U.S. Immigration Commission produced a dictionary of races and peoples as a guide for its staff, and it ranked every group, with whites from Northern Europe at the top and blacks and American Indians at the bottom. This rising nativism accelerated after World War I as economic uncertainty and a fear of communism created a confluence of problems that led Congress to pass legislation in 1924 severely restricting immigration. The goal was to limit immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe, Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. Eventually, these racial ideas would be discredited in the United States, but Nazi Germany would take them to new extremes. These ideas would become the basis of master race theories and provided the justification for the elimination of entire supposedly inferior races, such as Jews. But at that time, America had no refugee policy, only an immigration policy, a very restrictive immigration policy. So for those desperate to flee Nazism, American immigration policy would help doom many of them to an almost certain death.
Well, there you go. That was a meeting this afternoon, or a partial of the meeting at 2 p.m. on World Refugee Day. Yeah. That place was so full of Jews, you can't believe it. I had the video here. The audience was at least half non-white and race mixed. So you can see where they're coming from. And from their point of view, you can't blame them. But from our point of view, it's suicide. Tolerance is suicide when it comes to race. She said that the Jews were a race in here. Jews are not a race. They like to play both sides of the fence. No, we're not a race. Yes, we are a race. No, we're a religion. No, we're an ethnic group. They're clever at that. They're very clever at that. Just thought I'd let you know, you heard all the outfits that are lined up behind this thing. Most of them were churches and government officials. U.S. State Department's probably the worst of all. So think about it, boys and girls, as chaos unfolds. It will be your chance to let your voice be heard. Yeah. Well, I see they convicted another 94-year-old former Auschwitz guard found guilty of accessory to murder. Quite interesting. These are very low-level people that if they had not carried out their duty that they were given, they would have been shot. This man was perhaps 18 when he was involved. They told him what to do. He was in the army, and if he just said, no, I won't do it because I don't want to kill the Jews or whatever, they'd have lined him up against the wall and shot him. Nobody talks about that. So now they've given this Reinhold Henning, was sentenced to 5 years in prison by a German court. Can you believe that? 5 years in prison for a 94-year-old man. These people are unbelievable. It takes the pity away for me. As far as I'm concerned, any pity I might have had for these people that were supposed victims, they take it away all the time. There's never any forgiveness or saying, well, look, this guy was a teenager, and they ordered him to do it on pain of being shot. Oh, that has nothing to do with it. Well, how about all those people that big shots with IG Farben and all the big corporations under the National Socialists, Hitler's National Socialism in Germany that made a fortune and never were taken into court? What about them? There were thousands of them. Thousands of them that were complicit in the war machine. And they never went to jail. They never were even charged. What about them? When are they going to pick out some of those guys that are 95 years old and say, look, you're the one that created the Zyklon B. You're the one who created all these terrible weapons. We think you're going to be tried. You need to be tried. You think that's going to happen? Not going to happen any more than happens here when George Bush is a filthy war criminal. Cheney's a filthy war criminal, and they need to be punished. But they won't be punished because those kind of people, if you kill enough people, it's odd that Hitler got caught and died, you know, because usually when you're supposed to kill all those people, you don't go to jail for a day. But if a guy out here, whether he's black or white or what, sells a little marijuana on the streets, he goes and get 10 years, 20 years, or cocaine, maybe more, or if he traffics a little. Don't you understand? It's those on the top and those on the bottom. And the only struggle is always those on the bottom against those on the top. Whites, we have our axe to grind. Blacks, they got their axe to grind. I'm sure mestizos have their axe to grind. Asians have their axe to grind. So let's start grinding those axes, boys and girls, because time is running out for those people. Time is running out for the ruling class. Your bullshit just doesn't fly anymore. It doesn't fly with any section, with any group. It doesn't fly. The blacks don't believe them. I'm sure the mestizos don't believe them. The working class and the white working class are finally maybe catching up a little bit, but they're easily sidetracked by guys like Donald Trump. Of course, millions of people are sidetracked by the witch of the Amazon, Hillary Clinton. It's so unbelievable. She's such an unabashed war criminal. These war criminals get away with it every fucking time. Got that? War criminals get away with it every fucking time. Don't you think it's time to make them pay? They need to be put under arrest. And if not tried here, tried in The Hague. And finally get some justice. You know how the big shots are always claiming about this terrible, terrible Iran, horrible Iran, warlike Iran. Going to drop bombs on everybody, Iran. Well, Boeing's deal with Iran will aid Bashar Assad and Hezbollah. You see how crooked these people are? Last week, Tehran confirmed its plans to purchase 100 aircraft from the American aviation company Boeing. The U.S. Treasury Department has already granted permission for such sales by U.S. corporations, and the terms of the Iran deal allow American banks to finance them. Legal though the transaction may be, however, its results are bound to be bad for American interests, for the people of Syria, and perhaps Boeing itself. Oh, they're threatening Boeing. Emmanuel Ottolenghi, God, what a name that is. Iran certainly requires new aircraft for its legitimate transportation needs, but Tehran needs those aircraft to run an illicit logistical operation that involves the ongoing airlift of weapons and militias from its airports in Tehran and Abadan. These flights are providing fresh supplies and recruits to the Syrian armed forces, Hezbollah, and Iran's own Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, all of whom are fighting in the Syrian civil war that has claimed the lives of 400,000 people since 2010. Yeah. It should be proved that the Iran Air is carrying weapons, supplies, or forces for the Syrian regime. The company would risk getting slapped with renewed sanctions. Such deals could also make aircraft manufacturers unwittingly complicit in Iran, support for atrocities and war crimes in Syria for Hezbollah's terror activities, thus exposing them to future sanctions, as if all these goddamn corporations don't involve themselves with killers, militias, mass murderers, dictators. They all do that. They all do that. More likely is the threat of lawsuits from attorneys trying to collect $50 billion of outstanding judgments for victims of Iranian terrorism. These could create public relations nightmares, if not costly legal battles. There you go. Boeing, pretty soon the other aircraft. If they're not selling to Iran, they'd be selling to Red China. It doesn't make any difference. Those crony capitalists, predatory capitalists, don't give a shit about your nationalism at all. Forget it.